is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong if you start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, a little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Well, if that's Jimmy Durante, then I must be David Rothenberg, which means it's Saturday. Sometimes it's Monday, because I'm on Mondays now, too, sometimes. It's the 13th, and it's a crisp clear. I took my morning walk around the deserted West Village, no one out. A crisp, clear, and beautiful June day. And the name of the program is Any Saturday, and you're listening to listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 listener-sponsored radio. Did I get it all right, Sean? Was that it?
Yes.
I get an A. Talking about grades, I don't know if I mentioned this. When Chris Rock was on with Governor Cuomo, he and Rosie Perez, in one of the morning sessions, the governor said, have you taken the test? And Chris Rock said, yeah, I got a 65 on it. I thought that was, had some mirth. Well, let's talk about you-know-who this morning. Get him out of the way. His name is Trump. they call him Donnie, little Donnie. He loves big crowds to talk to. He's going this Friday to Tulsa, really appropriate at the height of all the protests and against racism in the country. He's going to Tulsa, the scene of one of the most horrendous massacres in American history, where the whole black section of town was burned down and stores looted and His timing and his choice of things is just extraordinary. But he loves crowds, and I assume he figured in Oklahoma that there's a monopoly of people that worship his every ignorant utterance or every ignorant tweet. But they have to sign a waiver if they go to hear him, that if they get the coronavirus, he's not responsible, and they can't sue anybody. That's a real invitation, isn't it? Please come over, but I'm not responsible if anything happens to you. And he'll be maskless because he's a real man, macho guy, except when there was a crowd of people in front of his house down at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He didn't go out and talk to them. He had them cleared away and then went over and held the Bible upside down. But before he did that, according to his attorney general, he went down in the bunker because he was scared. It's what the children did in London when they were being bombed. He just had some citizens outside holding up posters, and he went down to the bunker. And so I'm going to give a name for Donnie now, and I want you to pass it on to anybody you know. My new name for him is Archie Bunker, or we could call him Archie in the Bunker. But there are so many levels to that that makes sense. He is Archie Bunker without the humor and without Edith. Well, he has Millennial, his wife, and he has the child we never see. This week he didn't want to change. He said he doesn't want to change the names of Fort Benning and Fort Bragg. You know, I spent 2 years at Fort Benning. I had no idea that it was named after a Confederate general. If anybody had asked me, I would have said, well, Annette Benning's father. That's all I would have figured it to be. But who cares? Change it, Donnie. If it's offensive to people, I was never offended by it because I didn't even know what it was. But being told, I would think, well, that's not a big deal. Change it to, well, I love the cartoon in the Daily News. There's a picture of a sketch of Benedict Arnold, and he says, nobody's named an army post after me. Well, who could we name it after? How about, oh, I know what he would like. Fort Obama. He'd love that. Well, we're listener-sponsored, and I'm not going to make a pitch yet. Let's play some Johnny Mathis, and then I'll tell you how you can support WBAI. Johnny M., let's hear from you.
Of life calling Mamela, and a voice with the fear of a child asking, I owe Mamela. There's no mountain too great. Hear these words and have faith. Have faith. Have faith. Child asking, I owe
Mamela. Wait, wait, there's no mountain too great. Hear these words and have faith.
You may not know the names Mark Messina and Jay Lebo, but they wrote that song for a little show called The Lion King. I imagine their royalties in a week could feed a family of four for a decade. There's a congressional race up in the Bronx, the 15th congressional, and the Times yesterday endorsed Councilman Richie Torres, which made me very pleased. It's a very confusing situation. Ruben Diaz Sr. is running. I'm a great admirer of Ruben Diaz Jr., the Bronx Borough President. His daddy, not so much. And I'm afraid that a lot of people are going to vote for daddy, thinking they're voting for the son. Daddy is really not who the Democrats want to run. But the left has done it again. They have 11 people, I think, running against him, all progressive, many out of the district. And so they're going to dissipate it, and a man who should not be representing the Bronx may very well win the primary, which is tantamount to winning. But perhaps if he doesn't get enough of a majority, some people might put Richie Torres, who's been an outstanding councilman, who I'm not endorsing, but he is an outstanding city councilman, particularly on public housing. He has been the voice in behalf of people in public housing. And he's a bright, handsome young man, and he would be a very, very attractive representative from the Bronx in many, many different ways. But Ruben Diaz Sr. is leading the polls, and he's been around since Hector was a pup. So he has a following, and he gives out a lot of gifts at Christmas time and has over the years. But those of you in the Bronx 15th Congressional District, take a long look. A lot of primaries coming up. My congressman, who is Jerry Nadler, his office in the last 2 years, when I would call on a particular issue a year ago, a very important issue, phone calls, emails, and letters identifying myself, one as a constituent, two as a host of a radio program, three as a former state committee man, could not get a response from anybody in his office. In the meantime, I'm getting mail and taped messages from him every day. It's interesting how his office can suddenly find me now, and I couldn't even get the courtesy of talking to someone about a major issue. Even letters, after the emails and the phone calls fell through. I ain't voting for him. I don't know who I'm voting for because I don't know who the challenges are, even if there is even one. We're listener-sponsored, and we get you to support us, and we have a wonderful gift for you. I didn't know, I just pitch and then hope people call in, and there's somebody in a well out in Long Island, because it's a 516 number, and I don't know what they're getting. But I just found out that there have been two dozen people have ordered or accepted our invitation to get the Marvin Miller tape. So that pleases me because I'm so proud of it, and I'm going to give you the opportunity. Marvin Miller was the first union organizer for Major League Baseball, actually, for all of professional sports. He changed the face of baseball. He changed the face of professional sports and is one of the most effective union organizers in the history of unions. Because what happened to baseball, and as he points out in the interview that I did with him 9 years ago, shortly before he passed away, was that the owners prospered as the players prospered. And not only did they add more teams, the television revenue added, but more people were employed in the front office, and more people were employed in the ballpark selling hot dogs, and in the parking lots, and in the adjoining restaurants and hotels and parking lots beyond Major League Baseball stadiums throughout the country. And so it changed not only baseball, but the cities in which they housed teams. That's why Denver built their new stadium downtown, because all of downtown then prospered from it. Anyway, I interviewed Marvin shortly before he passed away. The last interview did, it's hour long. It's historic for its content, him telling the story how he organized Major League Baseball, the roadblocks. Fascinating story. The players, very conservative, didn't call it a union. They called it a players' association. They had money for two people, him and a lawyer. They wanted Richard Nixon to be the lawyer. He tells that very funny story. Nixon had just lost the governorship in California, was plotting to be president, which he did finally achieve. But they thought that it would balance things. They said, you're a liberal union progressive. We need somebody conservative to balance it. And Marvin said, no, the owners are the balance. You need a team on your side that's pro you, not pro owners. Fascinating story. Anyway, that interview with Marvin Miller, one of my proudest times interviewing someone. It never has played on the air. It was lost. After I interviewed him, BAI in its infinite wisdom lost it. It was found a few months ago, and we're now offering it. You can get the whole hour-long interview. It's a gift to you if you make a gift to us of $50. And you can call us at 516-620-3602. A number you probably know by heart now, or you can do it on my enemy, which is called the Internet, the computer. I call it my enemy. Yesterday, it took me an hour. I had closed it, and they wanted a password. Oh, don't ask. I finally got on. I made 18 phone calls. You can do it on your friend, the computer. Give to WBAI.org for the Marvin Miller video, and Francis Fay is going to hum to you while you're getting that gift of you giving a gift to WBAI, and BAI is giving you a gift. Marvin Miller telling the story of how baseball changed and how unions can prosper.
Now the Crescendo proudly presents the fabulous Francis Fay.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. How do you do? How are you? May I present Jack Costanzo on bongos. Let me hear it now. I saw you there one wonderful day. You took my heart and you threw it away. Someday come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man that I love, and when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him. I've think when you're pretty, it does matter how you wear your hair. Horns up. He'll look at me and smile. I'll understand. In a little while, he'll hold my hand. And though it seems absurd, I know we both won't say a word. Maybe he'll be down on Monday. Maybe Tuesday, maybe not. But I'm bound to meet him on one day. Maybe Tuesday will be Eddie Grady Day. He'll build a little home just meant for two, from which I'll never roam, Terry, with you. So by or else above, I'm waiting for the man. Maybe he'll be down on Monday. Maybe Tuesday, maybe not. But I'm bound to meet him on one day. Maybe Tuesday will be Cleekly Herman Day. He'll build a little home just meant for two, from which I'll never roam. Who would but you? So by or else above, I'm waiting for the man.
I'm sure I was the only person in the history of Teaneck Junior High School in the eighth grade when they gave out those questionnaires and surveys to find out what you thought and what you believed in. And I put down my favorite singer was Frances Fay. I had seen her on the Milton Berle show, and I think I said to myself, there's something else out there, and I've got to find it. I'm going to find out where that woman sings and where she hangs out. I eventually did see her in person at Basin Street East when I was a grown-up. When brought backstage to meet her, my friend Ruth Cage knew her, and we went backstage. Little tiny thing with a big singing voice. That was from a song by the Gershwins, George and Ira. I failed to mention that in the second hour, we'll be talking with former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, whose book, Stealing Our Democracy, is finally coming out. One of the most harrowing, is that the word, harrowing, political stories that you'll hear, and one that we must pay very close attention to, because you will discover when you hear his tale of what evil people in places high up can do to distort and pervert the political process. Let me do a book review now, talking about that sort of thing. Howard Blum's Night of the Assassins, published by Harper's, reads like the blueprint for a first-rate movie thriller. But this saga is not a work of fiction, as revealed in the book's subtitle, which is The Untold Story of Hitler's Plot to Kill FDR, Churchill, and Stalin. Obviously, we know the plot failed, but that doesn't lessen the nail-biting or the unbearable tension and the unimaginable speculation of what-ifs had the scheme succeeded. How would history have been shaped? There's a clear hero leading man in Arthur Blum's tale. His name is Mike Riley, straight out of Central Casting. Big guy, broad-shouldered, former football star from the heartlands of America, small town in Montana, devoted a decade or more of his life protecting Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the 32nd president of the United States. More intimate, more intense than most bodyguard-president relationships, Roosevelt's physical disability was mostly hidden from the public and from history. Riley literally had to carry FDR, shielded him, and as reported by Mr. Blum, he did so with pride and with affection. Their relationship unto itself is steeped in human drama. And the details in the book, because they always kept FDR's inability to walk as a result of his polio, Mike was always there. If you see pictures of him campaigning, of FDR campaigning, or at different conferences, Riley was always there. And literally, when the public disappeared, Mike would pick him up and carry him. The book is focused on the Tehran conference in Iran back in 1943, in which the three world leaders were targeted. Of course, Night of the Assassins is overflowing with villains, men dedicated to kill FDR, Churchill, and Stalin. Knowing that the war was lost, Hitler was hunting to avert unconditional surrender, which is what FDR had advocated, and this was the impetus for the plot. Himmler, good old Heinrich, always ready, partnered with his Führer and engaged Hitler acolytes, generals Walter Schellenberg and Otto Skorzeny, among others, to bring this desperate last stand to fruition. The Allied leaders met in Tehran at Stalin's insistence. Iran, right, not that far from Russia. Which Stalin wanted to limit his travel mileage. They were going to discuss post-war options, but it was fascinating. He was impervious to the fact that the incapacitated, disabled FDR had to travel thousands of miles by plane, by boat, by train, by camel, to get there. Interesting aspect of it. The Nazis came very close to achieving their goal. Right up to the very last hour, they were Nazis ready to die for their Führer and the fatherland. You know the ending, but the path to the final note was perilous. And let me just add this. Fanatic devotion to a failing and demonic leader is recognizable to people who are paying close attention today. And that's one of the many reasons why Night of the Assassins, besides being a thrilling read, is a chilling prospect or possibility if we don't pay closer attention. Our next recording is going to be the delightful and very funny Betty Walker doing a sketch from one of the 9 sketches from her CD called Hello Seal. And if you need some mirth and merriment during pandemic protest era, which reminds me this, the front page of today's New York Times says, voters see a bleak future. I don't. The present is bleak. The future is going to get better because we're going to pull ourselves out of this. But they always make it, they miss the point. The bleakness is now. We're homebound, where people are getting sick. People are protesting racial obscenities that have been inflicted for centuries and has came to the forefront with not that the death of George Floyd was new. It was that it was televised, that we saw it over and over again, but it's just one in a history of racial abuses. So we need a few laughs. Here's Betty Walker, and I'll tell you how you can get the whole CD.
Hello. Sam? Hi, no, what are you interrupting? No, I'm putting one kid to bed for the night. The other one's still eating lunch. Yeah, hold on 1 second. Hold on. Let me get something in her. Marilyn, make a hum, hum, hum. Empty and fill. Hold on, Phil. She's testing me. Hold on. Marilyn, you're going to sit here, sweetheart, and you're going to eat this lunch if it takes us till 4 o'clock in the morning. And after lunch, you're going to eat supper. Make a hum, hum, hum. Go ahead. Taste it. It's delicious. Go ahead. Take another spoon. It's delicious. Yeah. Sam? I don't know how she eats it. I can't even look at it. Yeah, listen, what I want to ask you... Hold on 1 second. Hold on. The other one just got out of bed. Chickie? Chickie? What are you doing out of bed? Hold on, Sal. Mother put you to bed 3 hours ago. Why aren't you sleeping? What do you mean you feel insecure? If Mother smacks you, will you feel more secure? Now get into bed. Mother loves you. I said Mother loves you. Get into bed. Good night with love. I said good night with love. Say good night to Mother with love. Say good night, Mother, I love you. Say good night to Mother. Get into bed. I just see you looking at me. Say, oh, mad, yeah. Oh, she mad, yeah. She looks just like his sister now. Marilyn! Marilyn! Wake up and eat! I said, wake up and eat! Well, she fell asleep on me with the lamp chop hanging out of her mouth. Yeah, listen, Sam. I want to call you back. No, I better put her to bed with the lamb chop. Yeah. I'll call you back.
The whole CD is available, our gift to you, for $35. Betty Walker's Hello Seal. Do you realize, besides being very funny, how well-crafted that is? That whole part there, go to bed to one kid and the other one, wake up and eat. She's thought these out. She's written, every one of these is almost a one-act play with great humor. Betty Walker was very, very smart and very clever. When she was making this, she was a guest on my program years and years ago and became a supporter of BAI. After she passed away, her family made this CD available to us as a fundraising. Over 1,000 people have gotten Hello Seal during the intervening years since she passed away. And you have the opportunity now, and you might need a laugh or two, or what, or one or set. Recently, somebody called in and they ordered 3 copies to send to 3 friends who they felt could use a pick-me-up. So if you want the Betty Walker Hello Seal or want to give it as a great gift, what a Father's Day gift it would be. Does Papa need a laugh? I would think. 516-620-3602 is the number you call for Betty Walker's Hello Seal. And that other thing, give, number2wbai.org. Betty Walker, Hello Seal. And every week at this time, I do an essay called Out on a Limb. Here's this week's. Amidst all the paramedic statistics or the pandemic statistics, I learned that the greatest number of people registering positive are between the ages of 25 and 44, which surprised me. But that doesn't match the grim figure that 80% of the deaths are over 65 years of age. One could argue that maskless millennials are killing grandma. Of course, nursing home figures and prior conditions of vulnerable health will be found among the retired, but the cavalier attitude, selfish might be the appropriate word, of younger folks who see themselves as impenetrable is more than provocative. And I may add that last night, standing out on the street, I saw 3 couples, 3 young men, 3 women, probably mid-20s, no masks, all over each other, carrying cups of alcohol from a open bar behind them, of course, white kids, not stopped, would never be stopped. And they were violating every suggestion, every CDC guideline with an arrogance that infuriated me. Anyway, paying peaceful homage to the murdered George Floyd has less meaning if you're creating conditions that take the lives of others. Protesters, of course, are not the only unmasked marauders. There is a high percentage of 25 to 44-year-olds without face coverings, which might explain the earlier figures. One youngish man said when confronted about the death of an 80-year-old within earshot of me, well, he had a long life, now it's our turn. As one in the age bracket, he readily dismissed. My response is, who gave you the right to determine my closing date on the planet? Is wearing a mask such a chore, such an inconvenience, that you would allow others to die? And what is your response to the increasing number of children under 10 years of age who are being infected? When you join a march in protest, you're also assuming vast responsibilities, not the least of which is how sacred each life is. In the early days of mask wearing, I became an attentive statistician as I walked around the West Village. At the start, about 60% were paying heed to the CDC guidelines and Governor Cuomo's. Those not followers of the path set by Trump were mostly young adults, 18 to 30-year-olds, and the homeless. But as the days passed, the homeless men standing in corners and in doorways had assumed and put on face masks. Before the protest marches began, it was about 85% who were masked. Almost all the uncovered people I noticed were millennials, many of whom were in clusters ignoring safe distance guidelines, like the group I saw last night. At the outset, I assumed the role of Paul Revere, shouting mask at the naked faces, and that I was warned that I might get slugged by a defensive soul, 50 years my junior, so I altered my script and I began yelling, shame. Somebody must have thought I was yelling Shane. But I came to realize that callow youths not hearing life-saving guidelines did not connect their stance with accusations of shame. And most of them had on earplugs and were listening to some music in a far-off world, impervious to the one in which they were situated. One young man walking with a woman self-identified as his mother, and she, a casual acquaintance of mine, we stopped and talked, but he told me when I questioned him that wearing a mask was uncomfortable. I asked him if he thought that wearing one was a barrel of laughs for his mother, and then he gave me my pitch to the 21-year-old that it's as much for his mother as it was for him. Was he comfortable putting her in danger of contacting the virus? Is this generation, the millennials, any less involved than those in the past years and past generations? They certainly seem to be at the forefront of the marches, which I applaud, and I suspect many or most are wearing masks. Voting patterns of the young are always disappointing, though. It's been suggested that as each generation moves into a period of life in which they are paying taxes, face mortgages, health care, and pensions, they begin making connections with candidates and elections. Taking to the streets in protest is direct action after witnessing the senseless murder of George Floyd. Stacey Abrams ably pointed out in a recent New York Times op-ed piece that talking about voting seems too remote, too inactive. That will come later, she wisely observed. But with the pandemic, which is still with us, we're still talking about life and death, which is why people marched for George Floyd or kneeled for Trayvon Martin or vote because of Sean Bell. Here's my message for the unmasked. I wasn't born an octogenarian. It took time for me to get to this point. I, too, was once a kid with dreams, some of which were fulfilled beyond my wildest imagination. I traveled uncharted roads, which included sit-ins and marches and protests and political confrontations. I had four cherished years at the University of Denver, and after two wasted years at the aforementioned Fort Benning, I arrived in New York City hoping for a career in the theater, which was quickly fulfilled. Curiously and unexpectedly led me into the world of criminal justice and criminal injustice. So I've been to Broadway openings, dined and wined with movie stars, and was in the yard at Attica during the 71 inmate uprising, organically linked to what marching is all about on the streets of America today. I spent days with the peasant militia in Nicaragua during the revolution against tyranny. I watched the building, the castle, demonstrate that you can create a supportive environment for men and women formerly homeless and incarcerated to reclaim their lives. So I've lived to witness a dramatic change in the human experience, opportunities created because people confronted ignorance and hate and indifference. And Dr. King told us that it begins with a wake-up march of protest, but continues with day after day, week after week, year after year, decade after decade, work to instill hope and dreams and opportunities. And I always quote my friend, the late, greatly outspoken civil rights crusader, Flo Kennedy, who said, if you're not sure what to do, grab a broom. So to the non-mask wearers, or to the young man who was casual about the death of an 80-year-old, I am not disposable. I know I won't be around forever, just like you, but I want to go on my own time, not when a cop decides to push me down or when a maskless millennial coughs in my face. All of our lives are precious, mine as well as yours. Put on a mask and march proudly or kneel in historic defiance. I'm David Rothenberg. Out on a limb.
When I was a little boy,
when I was just a boy,
the devil called my name.
When I was just a boy,
I say now, who do you think you're fooling?
When I was just a boy,
I'm a consecrated boy.
When I was just a boy,
singer in a Sunday choir. I was grown to be a man, and the devil would call my name.
Grown to be a man.
I say now, who do you think you're fooling?
Grown to be a man.
I'm a consummated man. She loved me, love me, love me.
Paul Simon here on Saturday morning, WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. Listener-sponsored radio. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday. The protests, I think, were ignited and have been interracial because younger white people, for the first time, the video, they saw a young black man being murdered. And you see it over and over and over again. And that can ignite passions and understanding. I want to add to the dialogue on that. Many of the, some of the more notorious killings that we've seen have happened in recent years because of smartphones and videos. The history of America didn't always have lynchings, weren't taped and replayed. And so many Americans who have been impervious to it and shielded from this are now seeing a truth. But there's another segment of the population where this is happening and there are no videotapes, and that's in the jails and prisons of the United States. And while you're protesting and talking about and kneeling, thank you, Colin Kaepernick, for your dignified, ignored stance way before everyone else, that while you're protesting police indifference to human life, add to the agenda what happens in the jails and the prisons, the beatings and the murders, the Potter's Fields around upstate prisons in New York, unclaimed bodies that were brutalized and murdered. That's part of the, that has to be part of the dialogue too. So I call that to your attention if you're in a dialogue, in a protest about what's happening to human life. There are men and women in prisons being placed in dungeons called solitary confinement. Blessedly, New York City has decreased the amount of time and the amount of people. But I want to point out, as I often done, that the punishment inflicted on people who are often already damaged, you exacerbate the alienation. And that quote of hurt people, think that one through. So add to the dialogue the abuse, the murders that take place in the prisons and the jails of our country. We have another gift for you. There was a, it's two CDs and they're for $50. One is a panel that I hosted in 1967. I just found it a few weeks ago. It was on the stage of the Actors Playhouse after a performance of the play Fortune in Men's Eyes. There was no Fortune Society. The Fortune Society, a preeminent organization that advocates for the formerly incarcerated, gives a voice to the formerly incarcerated, that the organization came out of those discussions on the stage because men and women who had done time heard about it and started coming to the theater. And from that group of people gathered, the Fortune Society literally started on the stage of the Actors Playhouse. And 3 months before that began, their BAI hosted, I was the producer of the play, and I hosted an after-performance dialogue with three men who had done time, one of whom was Perry Thomas, who had written a book called Down These Mean Streets, and a representative from the city's Department of Correction. And that hour-long tape is history now. And that's available along with another one, which is a collection of my essays out on a limb, 16 of them, over a period of time. The first of which wasn't planned. It's just ironic that it was after the killing of Sean Bell, one of the young black men that was killed in the history of this city, carelessly and thoughtlessly by the police. And those 16 essays of Out on a Limb, along with that 1967 panel, can be yours for a gift of $50 to BAI, and you get 2 hours of history. And you can do it by calling 516-620-3602 or do it on the computer, give to WBAI.org. Here's Helen Humes with her witty lyrics and impish musical presentation. Irresistible Helen Humes, one of my faves, always gives me, she's a pick-me-up. You know, the probably largest collection of talented black athletes are in the National Basketball Association, and many, many of the players, led by superstar LeBron James, have been speaking out clearly during the protests. And all of the NBA teams except two, the front offices, have made statements of support for the protesters. One was San Antonio Spurs, which doesn't bother many people because their coach, Coach Popovich, has been one of the most, over the years, one of the most outspoken civil rights proponents in professional sports. And the thing about Pop, when you not only his players and former players, but when you hear opponents, players from other teams and retired players who never were with him, they always talk with such affection about Pop, who clearly got it, who understood the struggle, particularly for young black athletes who were so many complicated things, kids who were suddenly given million-dollar contracts, who have been thrown into come from rural areas, thrown into urban sophistication, and he's been a obviously the way people talk about him, he has been a uncle figure for so many players, and doing what a coach should be done. The other team that has uttered nothing until recently, after lots of articles in the papers and sports pages, James Dolan of the New York Knicks, the last team to make a statement. And it was so bland that it almost didn't exist. why is he in New York? Why doesn't he go back to Wyoming or where he's from? There used to be nothing more exciting in New York. I said that what makes you a New Yorker? The when a Broadway musical, when you're listening to the overture and the curtain's going up, that's exciting. Well, the fourth quarter of a Knick game in the Garden, when the Knicks are fast breaking down court, and the roar of the crowd at the Garden was like nothing you ever heard in sports. Not anymore. You don't even know who the players are, and it's because they come and go so quickly, and it's all a reflection on James Dolan, who's a buddy of Trump's, we may add. He just doesn't belong in this city. I don't get it. Sell the team and, open up a team in buy the Las Vegas Gamblers and have an NBA team there. Leave us alone, James Dolan. Leave town. Johnny Mathis with a song from Rent, joined by, you'll hear a voice, and it's Nell Carter, who you'll hear with him.
Minutes, 525,000 moments so dear, 525,600 minutes, how do you measure a year, in daylights, in sunsets, in midnights, in cups of coffee, in inches, in miles, in laughter and strife. In 525,600 minutes, how do you measure a year in the life? How about it? Measuring love.
Johnny Mathis and Nell Carter from Jonathan Larson's Rent. Good morning, Governor Don Siegelman. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, David, I can't tell you how much I enjoy listening to you and your show.
All the way in Birmingham, Alabama.
Well, it is so powerful. I wish everyone who spoke any language could understand and appreciate not only what you say, but what you've done and all you have contributed to the welfare of humanity and continue to contribute. And you have such a moving, deeply touching program that it literally...
Now, Governor, we only have an hour. And all of the accolades from me are wonderful and appreciated. But at last, I've been telling everyone about Stealing Our Democracy, the book you've written with the subtitle, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. And before this hour's out, I want to make sure everybody knows how they can get a copy. Let me give folks just a little bit of a background. In the state of Alabama, which has produced such stalwarts as Jeffrey Sessions, has followed very strictly the Southern strategy that Nixon applied, which was to make sure that African Americans were disenfranchised and that the white power structure held. But you broke it. You were elected statewide, only Democrat, elected statewide in Alabama, Secretary of State in 1979. Then in 87, you were elected Attorney General statewide, then Lieutenant Governor in 95, and then in 1999 through 2003, you were the governor, and they didn't like that. And I read your book. I've read it twice. I've told everybody about it. And you went to prison for several years, and I don't know what you did that got you to prison. So I wish you would tell us the story, and then people will tell them how they can get the book, because they got to get all the details. But I want people to hear what I read in the book and what you and I have talked about, the charges made against you, the judge that was at the trial, and how they dealt with you as an inmate, all of which is terrifying to me because we have a president who campaigned with a lock her up about his opponent. And I used to think when in those early days of Trumpism, that's what we don't lock up our political enemies. We argue and we defeat them, but we don't lock them up. But your story tells something else. So do you mind telling us? Is it painful to relive it?
No, it's not. And could I please give a little background? Because, you know, if I was a first-time listener, I would think, okay, you know, we've got this white honky from Alabama who got elected Secretary of State. But I want to give just a little background so people can put my elections in context. I was raised by two wonderful parents, and I was blessed in that way. And, you know, I was taught not to be prejudiced, not to use the N-word. I was taught to be helpful to others. And so I was led into a life of public service. When I was in college at the University of Alabama as president of the student government, I went into Mississippi with Allard Lowenstein, who ended up being congressman from Long Island. And we were, trying to put together delegations for the 68 convention to elect a peace candidate to dump Johnson and to elect Robert Kennedy. And I was involved in anti-war protests. I was a representative of the moratorium to end the war in Vietnam, working with those three stalwarts that led that movement. And in 1971, during the uprising. I was out organizing in Florida and the state of Washington and Mississippi to get people registered to vote and to get them to run as delegates to the 72 convention. After working with the Eli Siegel in the Democratic National Committee to elect McGovern, I went to Oxford. I had gone to Georgetown Law School. I went to Oxford, England, came back to Alabama, and worked to defeat George Wallace's attempt to take over the state party so he could use that as a springboard. So anyway, in college, I worked against Wallace. I was elected to the National Board of ADA 10 years after you, I guess, were involved in it. And, you know, there was really no reason why the people of Alabama should have elected me to anything, but I was the longest running Democratic office holder in the Southeast at the time that I was targeted by Karl Rove and his forces. And there was a reason for that. I was touted as a possible dark horse candidate for president and by the Kiplinger letter and others beginning in March of 2001. And it was around that time that is actually exactly that time that the state attorney general, who was Karl Rove's political client, initiated an investigation. We went through 9/11 and I had, as governor, had brought in five automobile plants to the state, Honda, Toyota, Mercedes, Hyundai, a second Honda plant. We'd expanded Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and I'd built 1,000 new schools and put a bunch of people to work building roads and bridges. I was confident of my re-election in 2002, and I only needed to win that re-election to jump into the South Carolina primary because I was fed up with George W. Bush's war policies, his failed economic and education policies, and I had done it all in Alabama, and I was ready to emerge to challenge him as a progressive Southern governor, not so different than Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton. I felt like I could have broken the Republican Party's stronghold on the South, and it was then that my troubles began. The forces of Karl Rove descended on the state of Alabama, and we had a major, major battle. It was later proven and admitted, proven by Senator John McCain when he was chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee, and admitted by Jack Abramoff in his book, Capital Punishment, Karl Rove's college Republican buddies, Grover Norquist, Ralph Reed, and Jack Abramoff, funneled $20 million of Indian casino money from Mississippi into Alabama to defeat me and to defeat a proposal, a ballot referendum that I had proposed that would have guaranteed every child a chance to go to college for free, and every child a chance for early learning. We had a proposal for universal pre-K and pre-college education on the ballot, and I was viewed as a threat, I think, both to George W. Bush, but also a threat to the economic monopoly that the Indian casinos in Mississippi had in the Southeast, and they didn't want any competition. I was ultimately brought to trial 1 month before. Let me back up. So I'm running for office in re-election in 2002, and it was going to be a close race because George W. Bush, you know, his popularity bounced from the high 30s to the high 80s after his invasion of Iraq and the beating of the war drum. He had been into Alabama twice. Dick Cheney had come in and lured Laura Bush had come in. They were all coming in to campaign against me. And I knew it was going to be tight, but we felt confident. And we had a great ground game. I had worked tirelessly for the people of Alabama for my entire life, and they knew me. That was the reason why I was able to be elected. On the night of the election in 2002, the last county to report was a solid Republican county. It was unusual because it was a optical scan ballot mechanism that was being used, and they should have been one of the first to report, but they were, in fact, the last to report, and were dragging their feet all the way up to the end around 11 o'clock that night. When they finally reported one set of totals, which was blatantly incorrect, they quickly corrected it and posted the results on the door of the courthouse. The sheriff escorted the poll workers and party officials out, the media out of the courthouse. It was locked up. The lights turned off. And then within 4 minutes, a second set of totals were produced. The one that was posted showed that I had won. So AP and CNN and all the major networks reported that I had won re-election. The third set of totals that were reported on the probate judge's website had simply erased 6,200 of my votes. And what was so shocking was that not only did they just subtract 6,200 votes from my total, it did not affect a single down ballot race. And so I asked for a hand recount the next morning, and before my team could get to this South Alabama Baldwin County, the state attorney general, Carl Rove's client, had seized the ballots and the cassettes and all the voting equipment, the computer, and taken it to Montgomery, where he participated in an illegal certification of the votes, giving the election to my Republican opponent.
Sounds like what happened to Stacey Abrams in Georgia last year a little bit.
There's a lot of similarity. In my case, the votes were simply hacked by a computer. There was a study done after the election that showed that it was they called it electronic ballot stuffing. But anyway, because the votes had been certified, because we had a solidly Republican Supreme Court at that time, thanks to Karl Rove, I was in a catch 22. I couldn't challenge the election because I couldn't show that there were enough illegal votes cast to make a difference. I couldn't show that there were enough legal votes not counted to make a difference because Karl Rove's client had absconded with the ballots and refused to turn them over. So I declared that I was going to run again in 2006. I knew that my chances of making it on the ticket were diminished, but I was still thinking that I might have a shot as a VP candidate, even though I had not won. I had not been re-inaugurated, so to speak. I went to the Democratic Governors Association meeting that December and made my speech against Bush and his war policies and economic and education policies, a speech that I was going to make to announce that I was running for president. But it was after that, after Bush's U.S. attorney came into office, that a federal investigation was kicked into high gear. Now, if I may, just for a minute, I want to give a little backstory on Karl Rove. After the 92 Bush-Quayle election, which failed to Clinton Gore, Karl Rove and his sidekick, his name was Billy Canary, who had worked in the Reagan White House and the Bush Hubert Walker Bush White House. And he was in charge of the ground troops for the presidential campaign. He was someone that the chairman of the National Republican Party told Time magazine that he was a political paratrooper. You could drop him in a state where something needed to be fixed, and he got it fixed. So this was the guy that Karl Rove palled around with Billy Canary, and they made a trip through Texas, and George Herbert Walker Bush basically chased him away. He didn't want to have anything more to do with Rove. And they came to Alabama because Billy Canary had a girlfriend there who worked in the state attorney general's office. They both ended up marrying young ladies from Alabama. Karl Rove moved to the Gulf Coast, a place called Rosemary Beach, and Billy Canary settled in Montgomery, and it was there that they coalesced and formed a business political consulting company and started working for the business community to take over the Alabama Supreme Court. And so my first run-in with Rove was in 1994 when the vote was heavily in favor of the Democratic candidate for re-election for the state Supreme Court. It ended up being a very close race and was decided by absentee ballots. The absentee ballots, which would have should have been counted, were ultimately not counted, were thrown out of court by a Republican federal judge. And I had testified on the Democrats' behalf, having been Secretary of State and Attorney General. I was then, at that time, Lieutenant Governor. But we continued to have political confrontations. And when Jeff Sessions was elected Attorney General, and then after when I was running for governor in 1998. So after Bush was elected and he appointed his U.S. attorneys, Billy Canary's wife became the U.S. attorney in Montgomery, and she began an investigation of me while her husband, Billy Canary, was working for one of my potential opponents. As the race, as the general election heated up, Billy Canary began running the campaign of my opponent. And so I've given you a little bit of background. So we've got a lot of Karl Rove involvement in Alabama, and we've got his attorney general who's initiated an investigation of me. We've got the United States attorney who's married to Karl Rove's business partner who's investigating me while her husband is working for my opponent. We come to the night of the election. I win. The votes are stolen, and the state attorney general, Karl Rove's client, steals the ballots, takes the ballots, and certifies my opponent as winner.
Let me ask you a question, Governor, and that is, were you a threat not only because of Alabama, but the you were igniting the African-American voting community in Alabama, and that was a challenge to the whole concept of the Southern strategy that affected Louisiana, Texas, Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina? Were you perceived as a threat beyond Alabama?
Yes, I think I was, and I think that's why I was in the crosshairs of Karl Rove. I had, as Secretary of State, I had expanded voting rights so that there were no barriers to registration or voting. Not just for African Americans, but I had opened the doors to people with disabilities, and people. I had ballots put on Braille. I had ballots put on cassettes so that the hearing impaired might, or the blind could use cassettes or Braille ballots. And we had major effort to enfranchise those who had not not had a voice before.
That was very strange. So let's get to the lottery. That seems to have been in the book, in your book, Stealing the Democracy. The lottery seemed to be, Mississippi didn't want it, didn't want you to have the lottery. What was that?
Well, it was both, John Lewis, Congressman Lewis, said that the coup de grace for me was not that I had appointed so many African-Americans and females as judges, but that I had proposed to give all of Alabama's children a chance to go to college for free. That was part of it. But the other part was that a lottery was going to open the door to a vote for casinos. And with that, I would be destroying the monopoly that the Choctaw Indians had in Mississippi. So Jack Abramoff at that time and his partner, Mike Scanlon, who was also a former staff member of my Republican opponent, began funneling money into Alabama to defeat me and to defeat my education lottery proposal. But that was the ballot initiative. So I was, after being elected governor, I proposed the lottery and the ballot initiative, and I was raising money for the television commercials that we needed, radio commercials and other advertisements that we needed to convince Alabamians that it was in their best interest to give their kids free college education, and we could do it for free through an education lottery. It was the campaign contribution that became the centerpiece of my prosecution. I was first brought to trial in 2004. The federal judge that heard the case said it was the most unfounded criminal case over which he had presided in his entire term, 29 years and 7 months on the bench. And after that trial, I announced my plans to run for reelection in 2006. And, of course, I was already running, but I had not formally announced. And as soon as within days after I announced that I was running, I was reindicted on other charges involving a campaign contribution to the ballot initiative. So to make this long story short, and I'll let you ask questions, but I was convicted of bribery because I put the contributor on a board on which he had served for 12 years under three previous governors and actually had resigned from the board. I had to convince him to go back on it. But there was no quid pro quo.
Let me stop you there. So a man made a contribution for the lottery, not for the lottery itself, but for the campaign to have a lottery, and you appointed him to a non-paying commission in the state that he had already served on for three terms, and And so the allegation by the attorney, was it the attorney general of the state of Alabama, accused you of bribery, but no money.
Correct. No, yeah, there wasn't any allegation that I personally benefited by a penny. There was no allegation of a self-enrichment scheme, and there was no proof of any kind of quid pro quo, much less an express one. Now,
so what was the charge?
The charge was bribery.
But if you didn't get money, how could there be a bribe? What was the? I don't get, I guess that's the story.
It's part of it. The judge told the jury that the campaign contribution to this ballot initiative could be viewed by the jury as a thing of value to me because I was proposing the lottery for free college education and therefore it would benefit me politically. It's the only case in American jurisprudence, before or since where someone has been sent to jail where there was no quid pro quo and no self-enrichment. But
so tell us about the judge.
Well, the judge and I had had conflicts for a good stretch of his political career and mine as well. He was on the Republican Executive Committee and had actually opposed the Alabama Education Lottery proposition that I was proposing. And we had his name is Mark Everett Fuller. His godfather, Terry Everett, ran for Congress, and I ran the Democratic opponent's campaign against him while Mark Fuller, my judge, was running his godfather's campaign. So we had several.
Should he have recused himself from being the judge in a case like that, since he had previous partisanship?
He should have, but he didn't. And it actually the conflict got worse. He was a district attorney in a South Alabama county. The judge, Mark Everett Fuller, was a district attorney before he became judge. And I got a call from the sheriff, and he wanted me to appoint the presiding circuit judge in that district as the DA. And I called the judge, and I said, "Judge, I'm probably going to appoint you because the sheriff called me and said he wanted you to be wanted me to do it. But I said, why do you want to leave a cushy job as a judge and go where you can go play golf every day and be a district attorney where you have to be in court every day?" And he said, "Well, I'm the only person strong enough to clean up the mess that Mark Fuller has left in the DA's office." And he proceeded to tell me that Fuller had had given his chief deputy a $300,000 raise that would have basically stolen $300,000 from the state retirement system. And so anyway, I gave the green light to the judge to go ahead and initiate an investigation into, you know, this pay raise that needed to be reversed. And it was ultimately reversed. Judge Fuller was embarrassed.
But he shouldn't have been the judge in your case. I mean, it's basic fundamental legals. I'm not a lawyer. I know that. So you had a jury. And what happened with the jury during this case?
Well, interestingly, before...
As I recall reading, it was a hung jury.
As soon as the jury was seated, one of the jurors began sending emails to her fellow jurors seeking commitments for conviction. This was before the government even put on their case. So, I mean, she should not have been a juror, but it was emerged, these emails surfaced after the trial, and that not only did they show that this juror was had a predisposition to, you know, to convict me and my co-defendant, Richard Scrucci, but she had a love interest in one of the members of the prosecution team. There were other emails that surfaced that showed that she had sent notes through the U.S. Marshals from the jury room to the U.S. Marshals to the prosecutors asking if one of the members of the prosecution team was a bachelor. And this is during the trial. They're communicating with a juror. And the reason we know they were communicating is because they referred to her in this email as Flipper. She was a former gymnast at the University, Auburn University, and she was doing gymnastics tricks in the jury room, and the jurors named her Flipper. Well, if the prosecutors were not communicating with the jury, how did they know that the jurors had nicknamed her Flipper? So there were all kinds of things going on. But you asked me how I was convicted. The judge, we had a hung jury twice. And the judge told the jury finally, they had been sequestered for about 6 weeks, and he told the jurors, "Look, I've been appointed for life. I can keep you here until next year if I want to. Bring me a verdict or a partial verdict." And so they brought him a partial verdict. On sentencing, I was handcuffed, shackled, and put in the back seat of a Chevy van, and
at the court. That's what I remember in the book. That because I when I read it, Roger Stone had been convicted and then told to come back in 6 months to start his sentence. But you were not given that time. You were cuffed right at the courtroom.
I wasn't given 30 seconds. I was whisked out of the courtroom, you know, hands against the wall, frisk, and, you know, my tie was taken, my shoelaces were taken, and...
What was the sentence? How many years?
88 months was the initial sentence. I ended up serving 5 years with long stretches in solitary confinement, starting with 30 days in the basement of the oldest and worst prison in the country, the maximum security prison in Atlanta. Then we were flown from Atlanta to Detroit, well, to New York and Detroit and Oklahoma City, and then eventually to Oakdale, Louisiana. So that's the story.
And you ended up in Oakdale Federal Prison in Louisiana. We keep hearing about federal prisons being country clubs, but as I recall in your book, you said you were in a dormitory with 150 people that was a converted community rec room or something?
No, it's just a big cinder block warehouse with a tin roof and, it's just, fans for, to blow the hot air around. I was initially in a room with 21 men. We were stacked three high in bunks and, it was so tight. There was only one door in, one door in and out and no windows. So we referred to it as the submarine room because it was so small. It reminded us of, living in what it must be like to live in a submarine. But
and while you were doing time, was it while you were doing time that the judge in the case were then taken off the court for his behavior? Not just in your case, but generally?
Yes, his first wife filed for divorce, alleging abuse and alleged that he was addicted to drugs and alcohol during the time of my trial. And she also alleged that he was having an affair with the court clerk, whom after his divorce, the judge did marry. And it was the court clerk who called 911 from the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta, and the 911 call, which was recorded, of course, can be heard on the documentary Atticus versus the Architect, where she is screaming for help and he is beating her. The Atlanta police did make an arrest. This is also an interesting thing, which you can appreciate.
Before you go into that, if the judge was taken off the court while you were doing time, and for reasons that were happening while he was the judge in your case, wasn't that a reason for an appeal to invalidate the case?
We tried every way we could. I didn't have a shortage of lawyers, and unlike most, I had good lawyers and the resources to fight. We went to the Supreme Court three times, but there are more stories. The initial panel that heard my plea and heard it started out with 47 state attorneys general that petitioned Congress and the 11th Circuit to let me out and petitioned Congress for an investigation of prosecutorial misconduct and selective prosecution. And that number grew over time to 113 state attorneys general from both parties from every state.
Including Bob Abrams from New York.
Including my friend Bob Abrams from New York. And I hope he's listening this morning. Hello, Bob. And but we just could not get any traction on any issue, whether it was discovery, asking for a new trial because the federal, we found out that through a whistleblower in the House Judiciary Committee that the Department of Justice had written John Conyers a letter that was sealed. And in that letter, which was published by the Project on Governmental Oversight, they admitted that the lead prosecutor in my case, who was leading the investigation, was in email communication with my Republican opponent's campaign manager. But yet the Department of Justice said there was nothing political about my case.
How much time did you end up doing then?
Five years.
And you got out what year?
February the 8th, 2017.
And my basic question is, how's your adjustment coming out? You don't sound angry. You sound controlled. I feel like I'm angrier than you are, having read your book and having talked with you.
Well, and we all should be angry by what happened. I'm not angry, but
I'm also scared. Governor Siegelman, I'm also scared because when I read your book and saw what happened to you, angry for what happened to you, but also when I hear the sounds coming out of Washington that they want to lock up their opponents and free their guilty allies. Mike Flynn out, lock up Hillary. Obama has committed a crime. It's scary stuff.
Well, that was the point we were trying to make back in 2006, when it was clear that Karl Rove had been directing the Department of Justice. He claims credit for the appointment of all U.S. attorneys and all judges during the time of the Bush administration. And they were putting people through a litmus test to ensure that they were all Federalists and they were all, you know, had the right ideals.
What does he want?
And they fired seven Republican U.S. attorneys because they weren't marching to Karl Rove's, drum.
Governor, what do you think he wants, Karl Rove?
Well, he wants notoriety and power, and he had that during the Bush administration until, you know, Congress was focusing on him because of his involvement in the firing, the U.S. attorney's firing scandal, and also because they were requesting, they had subpoenaed him to testify under oath about his involvement in my case. And of course, he was under investigation by Patrick Fitzgerald and the U.S. attorney and from Illinois for Rove's outing of Valerie Plame. And so he was under a lot of pressure, and Bush finally asked him to resign. And so he left the Bush administration.
They used to call him Bush's brain, didn't they?
Yes. And
I want to ask you, we're going to, you know, we're in our endless fundraising drive, and I will be offering your book as a premium, but along with a movie called Atticus versus the Architect. Is this a documentary film made about that's now in DVD? Is it a DVD?
It
that
is.
You sent
it's
me.
It's also available on Amazon. But yeah, Atticus,
what is the movie?
Sir, it's a documentary.
It's a story of the case or of your life?
No, it's a story about how the election was stolen and why, by whom, and it's an independent film. I was in prison when it was made, and I applaud the filmmaker for taking. He took 2 years out of his life to produce this thing, and it's an interesting and shocking documentary. But it shows you what can happen today if we're not careful, and we haven't been careful.
You know what? There are two stories that chilled me that we haven't discussed. One was that 60 Minutes did a story on this, and that much of Alabama they were able to get CBS blacked out so that people in your state couldn't see it. How do they have that power? Who does that?
I have no idea, but about two-thirds of the state, you know, did not get to see the 60 Minutes piece that ran February the 24th, 2008. I wanted to say something about your Fortune Society, because having been in prison and working with inmates, it became clear to me that there was no effort really for rehabilitation. There was no effort to teach life skills or job skills or reading or math skills, or and there was no effort by the government to find jobs for these folks before they got out. And, you know, most of these things the Fortune Society is doing on a daily basis. And it's the kind of program, the Fortune Society is the kind of programs that it just needs to be replicated in every state. And I certainly, you know, hope that it gets some traction now that we are focusing on criminal justice reform.
Well, when this pandemic's over, you've pledged to come to New York, and you're going to spend some time visiting Fortune, the castle, and to the residents, offices in Long Island City, and we look forward to that. I want to reflect on the terrible time that you were in Louisiana in prison, and you had been called into court for a possible appeal in Atlanta, which was a six-hour bus ride, and it took them how many days to get you that six-hour ride?
It was in Montgomery. It was closer than that. My lawyer at the time was Greg Craig, who was the first White House counsel under Obama. And my other lawyer was Clifford Sloan, who had been a deputy White House counsel under Bill Clinton and was the emissary for Obama to close Guantanamo. And so I had two good lawyers, and all we were asking for was a hearing to explain to the judge why they should allow us discovery based on the fact that we then knew that the Department of Justice had concealed emails from my prosecutor to my Republican opponent.
So it was a six-hour bus ride to Montgomery.
Six-hour car ride from Oakdale to Montgomery, and it took 49 days in solitary confinement before I could get there and get back. But that's the kind of thing that they subject people to.
If I may, as I recall in your book, they handcuffed you, put you in a bus, and you went to Oklahoma and Texas and Florida, all on the way
I was what they call black boxed. I don't know whether you probably know what that is, but it's of course our ankles are shackled and we have chains around our waist and we have our hands cuffed, but there is a black box that is put on top of the handcuffs so that it makes it impossible to, if you're clever enough, it makes it impossible for you to get out of your handcuffs. But those are usually only used for for crazed criminals or people who are known for having escaped before. But anyway, I was black boxed and I was shackled and I was handcuffed and I was driven, I was flown and driven by car and vans and locked up in solitary confinement for 49 days waiting for my hearing.
It was torture, intentional.
Well, it's interesting that you said that. I was the last solitary confinement was in the Montgomery County Jail, and I was in the medical unit where the lights are on 24 hours a day. They never go off. So, you don't sleep with a pillow under your head. You sleep with a towel over your face so you can get some sleep.
Clearly, you can identify with many of the men that I've met that have come through Fortune Society. You have done. You did not do five easy years. You did a rough bid. That's clear. And it was torture and punishment for your political perspective and the fact that you were challenging the Southern strategy of the Republican Party, and that scares me. Let me tell everyone, we're almost up with our time, Governor. The book is Stealing Our Democracy. You can get it from the publishers. I have their email. You can get it from Amazon and from
any of
New South Books, which is the publisher. But we're offering it too for listeners with the movie, with the Atticus versus Architect, and a copy of Stealing Our Democracy, which is just coming out. I want everybody that's listening to get a copy and put it on the bestseller list. People have to read this story. People who are concerned about the future of our country have to know what people in political power will do, the desperate means they will go to attempt to destroy a man's life. They clearly haven't destroyed you, Governor Siegelman, but they put you out of commission for 5 painful years. And, you know, several times reading the book, I just threw it down, and I was hurting for you. I was angry at them, and I was scared for my country. And if you right now want to pledge $100 to listener-sponsored BAI, you can get the book and the movie, which is called Atticus versus Architect. Call us at 516-620-3602, or go to our on that funny machine, the computer, give to WBAI.org. I do it right now. Governor, you're going to come visit us when the nonsense goes away. Are you all safe down in Birmingham? I'm reading that a lot of the states that opened up quickly are having an uptick. Are you in your area? Is there an increase in numbers of people being identified with the virus?
There is an increase, but those of us with some sense wear masks and social distance and don't get out of the house quite as much. I want to add one thing before we close.
Before you add that, I want to make sure. How's your wife and your kids? Everybody stood by you. They're all with you, and they're. And you're back with your family, and that's, you know, happy ending, hopefully?
Well, a happy ending. My children were impacted by this. They were 11 and 14, and now they're 35 and 32. Their lives have been impacted, and I hopefully they have grown and grown stronger. I want to quickly add, this book is not about me. It's about saving our democracy. Look, George Floyd and the many people who gave whose lives were taken before paid a price, and now it is up to us to change policies, politics, and laws to protect those who are the most vulnerable, protect them from abuses of power by police, prosecutors, or presidents. And the point of my book is, if this can happen to me, think about what can happen to, an unemployed housewife or a hairdresser or one of the people laid off because of the coronavirus. If they can take a sitting governor down through the abuse of power by the Department of Justice, they can do it to you. Secondly, my book emphasizes that the family members of victims like Eric Gardner or Breonna Taylor or any of the others that have come before and hopefully won't come after, but family members deserve the right to have a lawyer present in the grand jury to keep a check on prosecutors who are going to do their best to let cops off the hook and no bill those police officers who have committed murder. So we've got to change our justice system to ensure that both targets of a grand jury and the victims of abuse of power by police have the right to have a lawyer present in the grand jury to ensure fairness. We do this in a civil deposition. Both lawyers have an opportunity to object to evidence or testimony. If we do it when monetary damages are at stake, we surely ought to do it when someone's life or liberty is at stake.
Governor, so, I can amen that, and autobiographically, in the very early days of Fortune Society, a young man came to me, his name was Danny Hogan, from Paterson, New Jersey, and he had witnessed a murder in the Vroom building. He was out on bail, but he had witnessed a murder, and he told me all about it, and when he was then whisked away, sentenced, and murdered in prison, and I was called before the grand jury in Mercer County, New Jersey. And the first thing said to me was, I had no lawyer, of course, that anything you say that can't be proven, you will be charged with perjury. And that was my greeting from the DA about, and all I was going to testify is that this young man had told me about having witnessed murders, and he was murdered. And I saw then how the system can corrupt and corrode. And I remember my train ride back from Trenton to New York, and I thought, they killed this kid, and I can't talk about it. But I've never stopped talking about it since. So I amen to what you said about what has to go on in grand jury. The whole system has to be, we have to get a new blueprint, because we have a blueprint for criminal injustice. Now we need one for criminal justice. Well, Governor Siegelman, Don Siegelman, the book is Stealing Our Democracy. You've given us a near hour of important information, and maybe we can pull it all together. And I look so forward to your coming to visit us soon.
Well, I'll be there. I will be there, and I look forward to meeting you. You're a hero, and you're my hero. So, and I look forward to
Mutual Admiration Society. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Governor Don Siegelman, the book and the movie, both in my hands right now, Stealing Our Democracy and the movie Atticus versus Architect, $100 to BAI. Call us at 516-620-3602. And if you just want to get the book, call Amazon or if any bookstores. The publisher is newsouthbooks.com. I don't know the exact email for them, but I guess that should do it. Newsouthbooks.com. Stealing Our Democracy by Governor Don Siegelman. It says on the cover, the biggest political target of all the Bush White House and the Karl Rove prosecution machine was in Alabama, Scott Horton, human rights attorney and journalist. I add to that. I've read the book. It's devastating. I invite you to read it and to learn about what has happened in our country and what could happen. Some closing music so I can get my bearings again. Maybe A Little Fever by Francis Fay. That will get us out musically, will it not?
Just a little of it.
Just a little of it.
I'm the gang. Let me hear it now for Jack Costanzo. Come on, everybody. Thank you very much. Right now, may I present my ex-husband on saxophone? What is your name again? I want you to meet Jay Goldfarb, who is playing the sax tonight. What are you going to do? You going to cool it, or are you going to stay over there?
Well, I'm going to stay over here.
All right, let me hear it. I want him to play our song, because it's so sacred. Play something homey, nothing, you know, nothing too wild. Go. I love you. never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
That's it for today. I'll be on Monday at 10 o'clock and next Saturday. And Carly Simon will say goodbye in the appropriate fashion. Please give us a call if you want to pledge and get that the book, Governor Don Seelman's book and the movie, 516-620-3602. Carly Simon, take us home.
Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website, WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
What lies ahead in these turbulent times? On the next alternative radio, hear Naomi Klein and Arundhati Roy on Surviving the Future. That's alternative radio, heard Saturdays at 7 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM New York and streaming live at WBAI.org.
New York City, 2020 is a huge opportunity to make our voice heard. This year, we have the power to decide our city's future, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next 10 by getting counted in the census. The census is about power, money, and respect for our communities. If our city is undercounted, we risk being underrepresented, especially our communities of color. In 2010, only 62% of New Yorkers responded to the census, with the lowest response rates in our black and brown communities. In 2020, I'm going to tell you something. We can let this happen again. If you want to stand up to the status quo and the five people in power who wants to silence us, start by getting counted in the census. The census is safe, easy for everyone. And remember, the citizenship question is off the census. No matter what anybody tells you, immigrants with or without papers count too. Mi gente presente. Go to my2020census.gov now and fill out 10 simple questions to get counted.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.
All right.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York.